Yep. Okay. Give me the intro and let her rip. And for those of you listening on audio, Alex is introducing me. Thanks, Alex. And it's actually a pleasure to be here, even though it is a Saturday. And in case you're wondering, it's a miserable, rainy Saturday here in Moncton, so I'd be sitting around the house anyways. So it all kind of worked out pretty well. Sipping my coffee. Oh, I forgot. I can give you video. Maybe. We'll see if the video works. There we go. So there I am. Or here I am, more accurately. And oh yes, and I've got one of my usual visitors, and you should see. So that's my life. And in case you're wondering which one that was, this is Polly, and this is Cat Bearding. Yeah, okay. We have four cats, and that's Polly, and she's very dusty. All right, so. The topic for today is MOOCs, or OERs, MOOCs, and the future. And Alex said this is one of the few interactive sessions that you have in this course. So I actually want to make it pretty interactive and have all of you participating instead of just sitting there listening to me, because although I am a fascinating person, I'm not that fascinating. And we don't want me listening, or we don't want you to be listening to me for the whole presentation. So here's the quick overview of the talk. I'm going to talk about open educational resources. I'm going to talk about massive open online courses, and then finally, I'm going to talk a wee bit about the future. But as I say, most of all, I want all of you to talk. It's going to be a bit hard because, of course, ooh, six cats, that's impressive. It's going to be a bit hard because it's hard to get people, all the people on the microphone at once. But there are ways you can participate without jumping in on the microphone. And that's to add comments to the slides. And hi, Michelle. It's don't worry, we're just getting started. I've just introduced myself, or Alec introduced me, and this is actually the first slide. So I'll be asking all of you to make comments on some of the slides. And here's how to do it. First of all, hit the little arrow beside the A, and that gives you a choice. And then select the big letter A. and then click anywhere on the I don't know what to call this color, mustard, on the mustard screen, and then type your message like that. Why don't you give it a try? And what will happen during these times when you're typing is I'll fill in some of the audio time with comments on what I'm seeing. For example, I'm seeing message, hello, hello everyone. Alex, if you want to jump in at any time when they're typing messages like this, this is a perfect time for you to jump in with your own comments, questions. Also, if anyone else wants to talk, again, while we're putting stuff up here, this is a perfect time to jump in with some comments. And if you want to speak, I assume there's a way for people to speak in this environment. Alec, how would they indicate that they want to talk? Okay, now, and I'm also wanting to capture images of these slides as we go along so that my actual slide record will be the slides that you people have created, not simply the empty slides that I've created. So I'll be capturing these as we go through. And so there we go, I've captured that one. Okay, so I can see most of you followed the instructions pretty well. I do see that one person didn't. This person here. This is what happens if you type the... Whoops. Gotta get my right. All right. Most of you followed the instructions, but this person here didn't. This is what you get if you click on the little A instead of the big A. Click on the big A. And the reason for that is because you get these boxes and you can never see what the person is typing, and you have to move it up and down and up and down and all of that. And then it gets really hard. You might want to try experimenting with color as well. If you look to the lower right-hand side, you can see that you can type in other colors as well. And that adds a bit of variety. All right, so that's the, you know, feel free to experiment. Nothing bad can happen if you experiment. Feel free to write on any of the slides, not just the slides that are designated for writing. So, all right, so let's get moving on this. First topic is open educational resources. And that's a term made up of three individual terms, open, educational, and resources. So let's begin by having you enter what you think is meant by the word open in open educational resources. So in this space here, type, just like you did in the previous slide, type out what you think is meant by open. And we see accessible for free. We see available for everyone. Free, accessible. Someone's typed access and reusability. Someone has typed freedom. Part of a network. That's interesting. You can use Remix, open to all, accessible no matter where you are from and where you go, searchable, sharing in a nice light blue there, no cost, able to remix, able to add on, love all, serve all, basically. And is that you, Alex? I think that's you. Or your cats. Copyleft or public domain license. part of a collective. That's interesting. I wonder why part of a collective would be part of what's meant by open. That's an interesting thing. Access for everyone, shareable resources that are education-based, inviting, creative. So we're getting some themes here, right? We're getting the theme having to do with money. That's my dollar sign. It's not very good. We're getting the theme of accessibility and availability to everyone, which has to do with no gatekeeper. I would certainly agree. We're getting the theme of licensing or public domain licensing. And we're also getting the theme of reusability. And this comes up with the idea of dispersing knowledge and also shareable. And of course, someone has put down Creative Commons. So I think we have a concept of open. We have a concept of open that has a number of different dimensions, and these dimensions will impact what we think of as open in open educational resources. Let me capture this slide, and this will take me just a second here. There's probably an easier way to do it, but okay, and putting it into here. Control V. Oops. There we go. All right, so you can probably guess where we're going to go next. Yeah, that's definitely what I'm trying to do. I'm actually not opening this up as much as I would like to. In my ideal world, this session would be freely available to anybody online and not just to participants of this course. Now, of course, you can't have. Oh, okay. Well, that's it. I didn't know that. But they still have to come into this Illuminate environment. But still, that's great. I'm recording audio, and this audio will be available, but not the full audio, just my side, because I've had some technical issues. But what I'll do later, or I'll try to convince Alec to do, is create the audio and video recordings of this from the original Illuminate recordings. And he's saying, yes, no problem. I think that's to me. So yeah, and I don't know if it counts as modeling if you say you're modeling it, but that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to model this, I'm capturing this, I'll make this available on my website, etc. But let's move to the next item because we have a limited amount of time and I've already used up a lot of it. I tend to have these very ambitious presentations. So what do we think of, and this was a big issue for many years, what do you think we think of when we think of educational, what do we mean by that? And again, type your answers in. I think this is a harder question, isn't it? And because you can't just say, well, educational means to learn stuff, although somebody did that, because that's circular, right? What is educational to learn? What is learning? Educational. Helpful, that's interesting. Learning and reflecting. Resources, curriculum based. I'm sorry, I shouldn't tease your typing speed. Although, I wonder why it came out like so. Mostly they just pop up, but yours came out as you typed it. That's interesting. More than just the school system, I certainly agree. There's this division in the field of online learning between formal and informal learning. And formal learning, of course, is the learning that takes place in the school system. And informal learning is the learning that takes place outside the school system. You know, there's been a lot of talk over the years about whether there should be special educational licenses for open educational resources. But educational licenses generally are interpreted to mean somewhere inside the formal school system, which would mean that you cannot use it or have to pay a cost to use it in order to support informal learning. What else we got here? Values, knowledge that society finds important. Okay. That's an interesting, raises interesting issues about who decides whether something is educational, who decides what's important, who in the end is the agency that determines the curriculum. Students interacting with the web, that's an interesting aspect of educational, isn't it? You know, we tend to think of educational as resources that teach us stuff. But here, this students interacting with the web suggests that educational has a broader definition than that. Extending horizons, expanding thought, these are definitions of education based on outcome or result. It's interesting. We can have a definition based on outcome, or we can have a definition of educational based on process or methodology. Myself, I tend to prefer to define education according to how the resource is used. If it's used in an educational manner, doesn't matter what it is, to me, that makes it an educational resource. This is a really great list on this slide. I love this. You got good students here, Alec. asking questions, sharing, provides an opportunity for someone to learn something. Student to teacher communication, student to student, student to content. That sounds like more to me. Can more be extended? Can the interactions in transactional learning be extended? Terry Anderson adds to more by talking not just about communication, but by talking about presence, which is something over and above communication, I think. And the idea here that you're inserting yourself in some way into the materials and into the resource. Presence can include, you know, supportive environments, safe environments, an attitude or culture of reflection. When institutions try to foster what they call excellence, they're trying to build kind of a cultural presence. I think I might be taking Terry Anderson a bit beyond where he intended that to go. But all right, let me capture this. Excellent slide. I love this slide. This is fantastic. Okay, new capturing. Captured, copying, moving to my PaintShop Pro, pasting, and coming back to Blackboard Collaborate. That's my copying. It's not very efficient, is it? I wish I could just do a one button anyhow. I wonder if there is a way. I don't think there is in Blackboard. It'd be kind of cool. All right. So we're getting a sense of what we're talking about here, right? We're talking about open resources. Remember all the things we talked about in open, free, accessible, available to all. And then what are they? They're these resources that help us learn, help us communicate, help us extend our horizons, expand our thought. Things that help you interact, that provide an opportunity for someone to grow, to acquire information, to add skills. Adding knowledge, positive or negative. All right, but what are they? And this is the third part of the definition. You probably saw this slide coming. What do you think we mean by resources here? And once again, I'll ask you to type in your answers or your comments or your thoughts. And there's always a little lull because it takes people a certain amount of time to type those words. people, places, things, and or experiences. That's interesting because it brings out the idea that a person can be a resource. And you have to ask yourself, well, how would you do that technically? How would you implement that online? Somebody's using the wrong letter. places, similarly, places. Yes, a place can be a resource, but how do you do that digitally? Video, podcasts, articles, chat texts, auditory. Now, we just had a bunch of stuff that fell on top of each other. Thank you for moving it. I really appreciate it when you move it because it makes it a lot easier for people to read. Anything that allows the students to explore their learning in a deeper way. Yeah, I agree because my definition is, you know, anything that's used educationally is an OER. But when I ask what a resource is anything a good definition? I guess what I'm looking for in this slide, and you know, it's something to think about, I'm looking for maybe examples. That's why I like video, podcast, articles, or perhaps more limiting definitions like tools or a vehicle for learning. It's interesting to think of the different ways you can define a term. You know, I go back to, you know, reading Plato, because my background's in philosophy, and reading Plato, and Plato asks somebody, you know, what is goodness? And the person comes up with, well, you're helping a friend, lending them money, curing the sick. And Plato says, no, that's not goodness. That's just examples of goodness. But what is goodness? And that's the sort of question that comes up when we're trying to define terms. You know, do we define terms by examples or do we define terms some other way? The formal way of defining a term is to identify the larger class to which it belongs and then identify what distinguishes it from other members of that class. So what is a dog? A dog is a mammal that barks. Okay, it's not a formal definition because there might be other mammals that bark. I don't know of any offhand. Maybe seals, but I don't know if seals are mammals. Someone can look that up. Are seals mammals? I should know that. I don't think they're rodents. Anyhow, but you get the idea, right? What is a dog? Something larger, a mammal that barks. So what is a resource? Well, that's a good question. This is a tangible unit of information is an interesting definition because what is a resource? It's a unit of information that is tangible. Okay, YouTube videos, that's an example. Canvas instructors, that's an example. We really get the sense here that there's a wide variety of things that can be an open educational resource. Some of them are very specific. I'm looking for, you know, it's funny. I'm not seeing anything that is a specifically educational resource like textbook or workbook or anything like that. Your definitions are much wider than what might be a more traditional view of this. We've got tweets in here, Twitter, audio, and I agree. I think it really should be that wide. I'm going to copy this slide now. So opening up my snipping tool, capturing my area, copying and pasting. So open educational resources. So we have this wide range of resources that are used in some way to support education. And what that means is supporting learning, reflecting, dialogue, communication, and all of that, and also that are open. And now it raises the question, right? Like, take any one of these things, right? Let's take a tweet. I'm just picking at random, and sorry about that circle. It wasn't a very good circle. Let's come back now to our definition of open. Open to all. Again, I'm just picking something at random. So open to all and tweet. And we have to ask now, is this a consistent or an inconsistent account of an OER? Is a tweet in a meaningful way open to all? And that depends on what we mean by all. Now, of course, we're working in the online environment, so we kind of mean all internet users. Because, you know, we're probably not thinking of people who don't have access to the internet. Although, you know, the whole concept of open eventually has to address that question of accessibility of internet technologies in general. But now, not even all internet users have access to tweets, right? Because to access a tweet, you need in some way to go to Twitter. One of the first questions that comes up, do you need an account in Twitter to view tweets? Now, I don't think you do, but contrast that, say, with a Facebook posting or a LinkedIn posting where you do. Jocelyn, you would like to comment. Please go ahead. Well, it makes perfect sense to me. One of the reasons why I'm in this field to begin with is around the whole question of access to resources. This has nothing to do with open education or resource, but one of the reasons why I was able to do well in education and to succeed more or less, you know, through my university degree and in later life is because my mother purchased the Penguin set of classics and put them on a bookshelf in the upstairs hall and said, these are my books, you can't read them without permission, which of course made us all want to read them. And so I spent the better part of my childhood reading classic literature. You know, everything from Twain to Jack London, a little bit of Dickens, which I didn't like very much, Stephen Crane, and I could go on and on, right? This had to help my education because I'm reading these, you know, at a fairly young age. And even if I'm not really understanding them, I'm still getting a great deal out of them. And it was all about access, you know, and all of this great literature can exist and be really useful, but if a person doesn't have the means to access this literature, what good is it? And I think it's the same thing with online learning materials of any sort. If you don't have the device to access them, then it's like they don't exist. And if you don't have the means of using that device in order to get at them, it's like they don't exist. I think now even of my work as a researcher in online learning, it's still not made of money. And I don't have access to a major university library. So if somebody publishes something in a closed academic journal, or if somebody publishes something only as a book, to me, it's like it doesn't exist to me because I can't get at it. And so that my research is impaired by the fact that I can't access these materials. And yeah, so what? I mean, I can get by, but somebody who's in grade one, grade two, grade five, they can't get by. They need access. Saul Barrows is asking, isn't all education limited by access? And I agree that it is. Clearly, all education limited by access. And even you look at any given learner, the amount of time that they have, the amount of resources that they have, what else they have to do in their life. There's a whole bunch of things that impact access. But I think we need to address that question head on. Alec, you wanted to jump in? Yeah, quite agreed. And Alan Levine is a good example of somebody who lives and works openly. Let me move on and let me chat for a little bit. So, that we've had a chance to think about open educational resources, what these terms mean. I'm just going to throw these definitions out there. And what I want all of you to do is to think about these definitions. They're all going to be different, they're all going to be similar. And think about how they differ and what sort of issues come up when you look at the different definitions. So the first one here, this is from Wikipedia. So it's not formal or anything, but nonetheless, it's the first line from the article. Open educational resources are freely accessible, usually openly licensed documents and media that are useful for teaching, learning, educational assessment, and research purposes. So they're capturing the three elements: open and educational and resources. Although notice how they've gone their resources, it's like documents and media. Educational, useful for teaching, learning, etc. And then open, they've gone with the phrase freely accessible, usually openly licensed documents, etc. So that's an interesting one. Here's another one. This is from the Centre for Learning Technology. It's British, therefore it's concise. Just kidding. Open educational resources are freely available teaching and learning materials which the author has licensed in an open format to allow others to reuse and adapt. So this is interesting. The issue of access here is covered with the phrase freely available. Now, if we look at what we've just defined as open, I think our account of open is something significantly more wide than that. They've covered educational with the phrase teaching and learning materials. which is kind of circular, isn't it? What's an educational material, a teaching and learning material? What's a teaching and learning? Yeah, doesn't really help us with a definition here. And interestingly, and they expand and open with which the author has licensed. And this is interesting because very often the author is not the owner and the author is not the person who does the licensing. In an open format, that's just awkwardly phrased. Do they mean that the license itself has been written in an open format? No. They mean that the license is to ensure that the material is in an open format, except that's not what these licenses do. Anyhow, badly phrased. All right, let's look at another one. This is the one from UNESCO. UNESCO is the organization credited with having invented the term OER, although I'm sure it was around before UNESCO invented it, but here's their account. Open educational resources are teaching, learning, or research materials that are in the public domain or released with an intellectual property license that allows for free use, adaptation, and distribution. Notice how this definition is using the nice format, right? It's first indicating what wider category are they members of, teaching, learning, or research materials, and then what distinguishes them from other members of that category. They're in the public domain or released with an IP license, etc., etc. The open part, free use, adaptation, and distribution. So that's interesting that they're saying use rather than access. You know, the UNESCO definition especially raises the issue to me of what is meant by open from the perspective of what point of view you're thinking of. There's two points of view here that come into play. One point of view is from the perspective of the person who has the resource in their possession. So it might be a teacher or educator or publisher. And the question now is, what can you do with this thing? And well, you can use it, you can adapt it, you can distribute it. This is the kind of open or free use of a resource that is meant by Stallman's four freedoms, right? The freedom to read, the freedom to or freedom to run, the freedom to reuse, the freedom to distribute, the freedom to modify, etc. Now, these are things you can do with a resource once it's in your possession. But there's another perspective, and that's the perspective of the person who does not yet have the resource. And now the right to redistribute is sort of meaningless. The right to adapt is sort of meaningless if you can't actually get access to the resource in the first place. My emphasis has always been on access. It's always been on from the perspective of the person who does not yet have access to the resource. It's fine to talk about what you can do once you have it, but to me, it's more significant to talk about actually getting it in the first place. When I look at a definition like the UNESCO definition, and it looks to me like a definition that is written more from the perspective of people who already have these resources and are looking to have additional rights that allow them to do what they want to do with the resources. Here's another definition. This one's from the Commonwealth of Learning. Open educational resources are materials offered freely and openly to use and adapt for teaching, learning, development, and research. It's interesting that the research aspect is brought up. It hasn't been brought up so much in our discussion thus far. Teaching, learning, development is sort of circular. What do we mean by teaching, learning, and development? Well, that's what we mean by educational. What is educational? Teaching, learning, and development. The use of development is a bit interesting because this is one of these words that can have multiple meanings, right? Development can mean personal development, Or it can mean economic development. The Commonwealth of Learning is an international organization that works in what are called developing nations, as well as what are called developed nations. And so it has a large development focus in its mandate. So I look at this definition, I wonder, well, do they mean personal development, personal growth, personal learning, or do they mean international development? And this is left vague. It's interesting, you know, you look at the different definitions and you see some of the issues that arise just in the whole concept of open educational resources. Now, these resources are widely available, and I've listed a few of the major sources of them. OpenLearn is created by the Open University and consists of full course packages. OpenCourseWare was created by MIT something like 10 years ago now, and these are all the materials used in MIT courses. Some international ones: China Quality OpenCourseWare and Japan OpenCourseWare Consortium. And if you want to find piles and piles more of these, you can look at the Directory of Open Education Resource Repositories. And this is generally where these things are found, are in what are called repositories. Although that raises the question whether this is the best and or the only way of distributing open educational resources. One of the things that came up in our discussion, as well as in the definitions, is the issue of licensing. Right now, Creative Commons is pretty much the only game in town. There are some older licensing, like the GNU Free Documentation License, GFDL, but that's basically not used. And I personally don't know of any widely used licensing schemes for open educational resources besides Creative Commons. Alec, if you know any, you can jump in right here. Creative Commons identifies four major types, or no, let me phrase that differently, four major variables with respect to open licensing. The slogan for Creative Commons is "some rights reserved." And basically the idea is if you have access to a Creative Commons licensed resource, then you can use this as you wish with some limitations. And here are the limitations. The first is you have to give credit to whoever created the resource. If this condition is chosen by the person issuing the license, then you need to give that person credit. Another major condition is non-commercial. A person issuing a Creative Commons license has the option to choose to add the non-commercial condition. And in fact, I attach this to all of my own works. And the non-commercial condition stipulates that you are free to use the resource, but only non-commercially. And that has raised, as you can imagine, a large amount of discussion. The big question here that comes up with regard to non-commercial is do they mean can be used by only by non-commercial entities? In other words, only by individuals or nonprofit agencies, but not by companies? Or do they mean the purpose of the use is non-commercial? So it can be used by anybody, provided that it is not used in such a way as to engage in commercial transaction. I prefer the second. I don't care who uses the resource. What I care about is whether they're using the resource to make money. And actually, and this will come up a wee bit later, I don't even care whether they use it to make money. This is me personally now. What I care about is if they block access to the resource, if they charge a subscription fee to it. And that's why I use the non-commercial condition on my work, because I, as a creator, do not want somebody else to come along and take my work and then charge people money to access my work. And of course, That comes up, that dispute comes up when we talk about what Creative Commons and others call the free culture license. And their definition of free includes commercial use, which to me is an oxymoron, but that's an aside. It's from the perspective of the whoever has possession of the resource, right? And it's free if there are no limitations on the use of the resource, which includes, you know, using it commercially. I don't agree with that, but it's certainly something that needs to come up. Another condition is the no derivatives. And, this is important in many cases to preserve the integrity of the work. This will often be applied to works of art. So if the Mona Lisa was posted online, it would probably be posted under a no derivatives license, because you don't want people putting pictures of mustaches on the Mona Lisa. It kind of wrecks the integrity of the work. At least that's the perspective. Somebody asked about copyleft in the chat area, and this is the share alike condition. The share alike condition is essentially, if you get my resource under a certain license, and then you share the resource again, you have to share it under the same license. This is sometimes called viral licensing. It's the original concept that Richard Stallman came up with the GNU public licensing. And it's the idea that the license propagates along with the work. Somebody asked in the chat area, being, as they say, a devil's advocate, which is code for annoying. I'm just kidding. How do you enforce all of this? And that's a darn good question, actually. And my attitude is, I don't. Life is too short to get caught up in disputes over copyright and licensing. Life is for enjoying, not messing around with this stuff. And in any case, I don't have the money. So from my perspective, when I license something, when I put a license on my work, I'm telling people, this is what I want. And it's up to them to respect it. And I know that companies and corporations won't respect it. And they'll do whatever they want because they've got millions of dollars and I don't. So they don't have to follow my license. Doesn't matter. Although there have been some cases where Creative Commons cases have been pursued in court and the licensing has been supported in court. So legally, the licenses are legally valid if you have the money to pursue the lawsuit. But I find that most people adhere to the licenses. That most people will, for example, not use your material commercially if you put an NC condition on your license, and they'll write to you and they'll ask. Just like, I imagine Nokia wrote to Alec and asked, can we use these images? And Alec said, sure, but you got to give me money. And I've had many people over the years write to me and say, I'm doing a travel thing. Can I use this photo? Or, this piece of writing would go great in a card. Can I use that? And I don't, I never even make money off of this. I always answer, sure. And because I don't care. I do care. I care enough to put on the license, but I don't care enough to pursue it. And I think that's my attitude. I think people's attitudes vary, although it's nice of Laura to say that's a healthy attitude. One thing I just discovered, this is why I do these talks, I just discovered today, looking in at the most recent versions of the Creative Commons quote-unquote free culture license, this condition, and if you go onto this URL here, you'll see this condition in this logo. And this goes a long way toward addressing my own concerns about commercial use. My concern about commercial use, of course, was that they take my stuff and lock it behind a paywall or a DRM wall or some sort of other restriction. But if you have a condition that says not only is the content free, but you can't lock it, well, that's most of my concern satisfied right there. So I'm going to be looking at this more closely because I think this is really significant. And indeed, if I had a way simply of saying you can't lock my content, then I wouldn't care about the other conditions. That's just, again, me speaking. Moving on, because I'm not sure how much time we have, but it's probably not a lot. So here are a few uses. I want to move to massive open online courses very quickly. I assume I only have like 10 minutes left. That's right, eh, Alec? All right. That's better timing from my perspective. So, yeah. Let's take a minute then, no more, to think about sustainability of OERs. And then we'll move to massive open online courses. So put down on this slide what your thoughts are about who pays for these things. Who makes them and how do we pay them? And no, you can't leave, even if you need to. You are forced to stay here. Okay, I've waited out the ringing of my clock. Why would anyone have to pay? I'm confused. Okay, so all open educational resources are created, which means they're created by a person, and they're all hosted on, in an online repository. So this creates costs. This is how the story goes, right? So there's the cost for the person to create them. There's the cost for where they are hosted. And so we have models like foundations or nonprofit organizations, universities or other educational institutes, teachers, and then they share. I like that. Public funds is a very common model. Individuals for whom philanthropy matters. Who else? Who makes them? Educators. You think publishers should make them? Do you think Pearson should be in the business of creating open educational resources? And that's kind of a model they would like, right? The government gives them a whole pile of money and then they make these resources. I mean, that would work, wouldn't it? Aren't many MOOCs like a course to advertise a university or professor and encourage more enrollment? That's exactly right. And so these resources are seen as an advertising investment. It would be nice if everyone did. Educators paid by public funds should only create OERs. So that refers to what are sometimes called institutional mandates. And the idea here is that if you work for an institution that is publicly funded, or in many cases funded by certain foundations, then whatever you produce must be made available as an open educational resource. And there are two models. And the models are the green model, where the OER is hosted in an institutional or local repository. Or there's the gold model, and that's where the OER is hosted by a publisher. And the idea is what you do is you pay the publisher an upfront cost, and the publisher agrees to make the resource available in theory in perpetuity. I examine the question of open educational resources at length in this paper. It's called Models for the Sustainability of Open Educational Resources, and I cover a lot of these models. I'm going to capture this slide, and as I'm capturing this slide, what I'm going to say is that one of the things that I argue for in that paper that I'm referring to is community-created open educational resources. And this, along with something that Alec raised a bit earlier, lies behind the foundation of MOOCs. And let me summarize what Alec said a bit earlier. What he said was, one of the disputes that comes up regarding licenses is with regard to mixing materials from different licenses in an online course. So, for example, if you have something that's licensed Creative Commons non-commercial, and if you have a different resource that's licensed Creative Commons by, so it allows commercial use, then the argument goes you can't take those two resources and combine them, because how would you license them? If you license them as non-commercial, you'd be violating the license for the one. But if you license it as allowing commercial use, you'd be violating the license of the other. And this is a problem. David Wiley has talked about this at length. And this, along with the question of who makes these things and how we pay for them, are two of the major incentives or two of the major drivers behind the creation of massive open online courses, at least for me. But let's approach the question of massive open online courses kind of from a roundabout way. So we have the idea here of a massive open online course as an open course made up of open educational resources, which kind of makes sense. And here's the slideshare where I outline this theory in quite a bit more detail. But rather than just telling you what a massive open online course is, let's do what we've been doing so far and get thoughts about what the different terms in this concept mean. So let's begin with, when I say massive, what do you think of as massive? And again, as before, type your answers here, please. And there's always a little gap. No set enrollment. Okay. Part of the collective neural network. Someone's been reading ahead. I heard of one MOOC course had around 20,000 students. Someone else writes thousands. Yep. Large number of learners. Nope. Came up with that myself. Okay. Good enough. Global. Interesting. I like this global. So there's no geographical boundaries. Can be misleading. Numbers can be small. Contrast that with huge amount of enrollers. An audience as large as the population of Beijing. And what is the population of Beijing? I should give a prize to the first person who can answer that authoritatively. The biggest MOOC was over 180,000 enrolled, and that's correct. You know, there have been hundreds of thousands of people in these things. Some of them, by no means all of them. So we're still waiting for the population of Beijing. And since I'm very impatient, I'm going to Wikipedia to look it up. And, Google tells me population 20.18 million as of 2011. Wikipedia population is 20.693 million as of 2012. So there we go, 20.18 million. That's a lot of people. And, just imagine a course with 20.18 million people in it. And there are two aspects to massive. One is, sheer numbers. But to my perspective, massive has to mean something a bit different from that, because if it's just numbers, then, the Olympics broadcast is a massive open online course, or, the telephone network is a massive open online course. Massive has to support education, which means it has to support two-way communication for an educational purpose. And the idea here, to my mind, is that massive relates to the design of a course rather than the outcome. Remember, we talked about different ways of defining things, right? You can define things by their design, you can define things by their outcome. Here, I prefer to define things by the design. And the idea is that a course is massive if it could, by design, support a large number, a massive number of people. And what is massive? I've been asked this. The minimum to me, for massive, is 150 people. Obviously, it can go a lot higher. Why would I say it's the minimum, though? Well, 150 people is Dunbar's number. And it's a theoretical number, and so, should be empirically validated. But Wendy says, does it make me a snob that I would not be interested in a course with 180,000 students in it? I'm not going to answer that. Dunbar's number is this. And maybe this answers Wendy's question. It's the number of people that you can personally know. So my definition of massive is a course that contains people that you do not personally know. Why is this important? Because if it's all people that you know, you can have a nice group. Everybody knows everybody. You have lots of interaction. That's wonderful. But if it's more than the number of people you know, now the structure of the course has to be such that people can form multiple groups, or as Joe Clark would say, communities of communities. So you have to have a structure that is not based on something being, or everything being, available to everyone. You need a structure where people can select subsets of the participants of the course with whom to associate, with whom to read, etc. This is, somebody wrote, collective neural network. And this is why I say, oh, yeah, you're reading ahead. It's a course that's built like a network rather than a course that's built like a large amphitheater or broadcasting studio. It's not just a broadcast. It's an environment in which people interact with each other on a one-to-one basis for educational purposes. And so I think Massive defined this way really puts limitations on the design of the course, because the design of the course has to be such that it supports massive numbers of bilateral interactions. So it's not a body of matter with no definite shape. In fact, the shape is defined by the criteria that it has to be massive. Jean Kay says, how do you create networks of learning with numbers that large? That's an excellent question. And that was the question that faced me in particular building these original MOOCs. Let me capture the slide and I want to move on. I hope you're finding this interesting. I find it fascinating. So, capturing slide, edit, copy, and paste in. All right. So let's move to the next one. And this is a question we've already visited. And when I was setting this up, I asked myself, do we want to visit it again? And I thought, yes, we do. Because before we were talking about open educational resources, now we're talking about open courses. So what do we mean by open? And now I'm asking you this with respect to courses. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I'm running out of time. But if you put down here what you think we mean by open. Available to all comes up again. And uses open formats. That's interesting. And that relates to the DRM question that came up with open educational resources. Content available to all, open, available to those with an internet connection and a computer. Available to students, to have students connect to others all around the world. Yes, absolutely. Open communication with other learners. Open in the sense of taking on a variety of perspectives. Yeah, I really like that answer. Open isn't just, from the perspective of courses, open isn't just about access and it isn't just about what you can do with it. Open has to do with taking on a variety of perspectives. It has to do with open enrollment, inviting people in, communications. In the courses that George Siemens and I set up, a big part of it being an open course was we put the curriculum into a wiki and then told people who might want to join the course, come into this wiki and change the course and make it more like the way you want it. A big part of open, from this perspective, is openness of objective, openness of goal, openness of ambition. People can enter the course even if they don't want to finish it. People can enter the course even if they just want to browse and look around. Interactions available to all, such as this. Exactly. The end is not determined, which is pretty much what I was just trying to say there. To be open means you don't have to give your email address in order to look at the course materials. That's always bothered me. I get email from companies saying, I have these open courses. I want you to advertise. And I go to their site, and the first thing you need to do, you can't see anything unless you register with your account and your name. And to me, those are just they're mining operations. They're mining user information. Adapting the course to your own learning needs. Yes, exactly. You see how open when we start talking about it from the perspective of courses now takes on this much wider sort of meaning than just openness of access, openness of use. So I'm saving this slide. There it is. All right, So having raised all of these, what do we mean now by online? And I think that's a really interesting question, because it's one of these questions you think you know. You know, how could you question what we mean by online? But do we know? We've seen a lot of MOOCs. They're called, the phenomenon is called wrapped MOOCs, where the instructor will take MOOC content from Coursera or Udacity, and they'll bring it into their university classroom, and they'll wrap their classroom activities around the online materials. Now, is that still a MOOC? Because now most of our activity is taking place offline. It's taking place in this classroom. It's not even open, is it? So what do we mean by online? Computer-based? Yes. Available with internet access? Yes. On the worldwide interwebs? And also things folks have copied from there, and sure, yeah. No face-to-face component, wrong app. Able to participate anywhere, anytime. Can be accessed or downloaded through an internet connection or data plan on a mobile device. Accessible via an internet connection. Yeah, it turns out online is kind of a fuzzy term, isn't it? We know it involves being accessible by the internet. But we also know that it doesn't mean being only accessible by the internet. And I like to encourage offline components to online courses, because I think personally that learning is about more than just sitting and staring at your computer. I like people to get out there in the community and do things. That's why I really like Jim Groom's courses, because Jim Groom has people go out and doing stuff with their cameras and their audio recorders and whatever. But I think that insofar as it requires offline activity, it cannot require some specific offline activity. If the course designers say, you know, have a meetup in your local community, that's fine. If the course designer says, come to the meetup at 49th Street in New York City, that's not so fine, because now the physical component has become very particular, and the course is now available only to those people who can get to 49th Street in New York City, which is not most of us. Even though New York's a very large city. So, yeah, online. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I know. Sorry, I was doing something. something related to this, but I completely agree. And one of the things that I've tried to say with regard to the MOOCs that we've offered is that no part of the MOOC itself is obligatory. That includes synchronous sessions. It includes asynchronous sessions. We've had people participate in MOOCs only by showing up every week at the synchronous session and ignoring everything else. And that's fine. You know, I think that's all part of being open. Somebody commented, I think snarkily, well, maybe not snarkily, but online physical education. So, oh, okay, well, that'll work. Okay, that's good. So, I just want to show you this. Oh, dang, how do I do this? Hang on. I'm going to capture this page first. Okay, so I've captured the page. Okay, good. Edit, copy. This is a long roundabout way to go toward answering a question, isn't it? All right, and now I'm going to come back to this, bring this back out, and all right, can you see that? You should be able to see this image. Can you see this image? What I'm trying to show you is the screen from something called Runkeeper. It's a map of one of the routes that I took cycling. You can sort of see the elevation, the climb, and the hills in that. This is online physical education. Runkeeper is a classic example, in my mind, of open online learning, or mostly open, because you still have to sign up and all of that. But it's free. I don't have to pay any money or anything like that. And basically, it's a system that allows me to track my activities, my physical activities. You can do running, walking, mountain biking, cycling, and a few other things. And I use this. You can connect with friends and things like that. It's a bit less open in that way than I would like, but still it's okay. And I have the Runkeeper app on my Android phone. It's a Samsung Galaxy S3. I just love that phone. So it uses the GPS, and as you can see, I can track my routes. This is online learning. This is online learning phys ed. You know, the idea here is that the content is online. There is an offline component, but there's not a particular offline component, right? I could walk, I can run, I can do this anywhere in the world. It doesn't matter where. And yeah, the ability to determine your own level of participation. I could put, you know, one walk a year in this and I'm still using it. I'm not getting a whole lot of exercise, but that's, they don't prejudge me. So I think that's really significant. I'm going to save this one too as a slide because I'm going to insert it. Because I think it's important that people see this and understand. This is what I mean by online learning, right? Sitting there doing a quiz on a computer is not what I mean by online learning. This is what I mean by online learning. I'd love to see this kind of thing for, well, pretty much any activity that we can do. You know, why just running and cycling? Why not biology and chemistry? You know, why not like ChemKeeper for all my chemistry activities? You know, today I mixed hydrogen and oxygen. Don't know what happened, but there were a lot of tears. Okay, that's bad. That's really bad. But you get the concept, right? So, anyhow, continuing. I'm just copying this now, putting it in my archive. All right. Finally, and that really does raise the question, what is a course? And I don't really have time to do a whole lot of interaction on this, but I will say, to me, a course is something, it's an event. It has a start, it has a stop, and there's something in the middle. I like that. The person who just wrote, it is the distance from here to there. I really, really like that definition. I like it a lot because it's the idea here, or like a path, a trail, beginning, middle, end. You press start and it tracks your movement. Oh, okay. It's the idea of the course is that it brings together people on an occasional basis and has the promise of a start and an end time. Somebody asked, do some courses never end? No, then it's a lifestyle, not a course. You know what I mean? You see the difference? And the reason this is important is that by having an end date, you lower the level of commitment required. You're not signing up for a lifetime. You can do it and then go on and do the stuff you were doing before. So it allows you to form associations with people. You might not form associations with people otherwise, because it's okay to associate with these people for 6 weeks, but not for a lifetime. Maybe you will, but you're not signing up for that ahead of time. It allows a space and time frame for students to explore concepts and engage in learning, a space for true learning, learning modules, but you control the learning, has a goal, a map, and a compass. You get the idea, right? A course is an experience with boundaries. It's a community with boundaries, and it's the boundaries that create many of the affordances that make it a course. I know I'm being a bit vague there, but I'm just trying to say that a course is something different from the properties that make up a course. A course is something, it is over and above just the events that happen in the course. I see you guys have all been putting stuff in this space anyway, so I'm going to capture this. And so, capturing now. So don't write anymore. Copying, putting into my archive. Very good. So, all of this combined leads us to the story of how MOOCs were created. MOOCs were created in order to work with all of these OER type repositories, thinking of them from a very broad perspective, from blogging sources to to-do lists, to personal hosting, to image archives, to content that might be put up on a learning management system, etc. All of these different resources scattered over the internet are connected to you, the learner. And then if we turn this, if you will, inside out, what you get is a MOOC. And here's a course as a network. And this is the original design for the Connectivism and Connective Knowledge course, 2008. And as you can see, we had a little bit of like real formal structure up here, but mostly it's just a whole bunch of things. Twitter, Ustream, Illuminate, the blog, Delicious, Flickr, all of these things all connected to each other. And the idea is that participants in the course would add their own blogs, would add their own videos, would add their own groups or comments, and the course would link them all together. And so the structure of the course is essentially the same as the structure of the internet. And somebody asked, how do you facilitate interaction and communication with millions of people? The internet is a device that was built specifically to do that. And so what we're doing is we're using the same technologies as the internet, but we're putting a bit of a border on it. We're saying it's going to start here, it's going to end here, it's going to encompass this set of links and this set of resources. But what you do in this environment, that's up to you. And it's open. You can enter and leave the environment as much as you want. There are no barriers around it. So the idea here is that we're creating these networks of interaction. Now, as time went by, this concept was expanded and in some ways broken. The really interesting expansion was the focus on tasks that Jim Groom and then later Alan Levine did with the DS106 courses. So we had our original MOOCs, which were these networks of connections. They adopted pretty much the same approach. The networks weren't as as extensive because they were using WordPress and WordPress had limitations. But they focused on tasks. They really focused on the idea of participants creating things. One example of this in DS106 was the assignment bank. Instead of the author, instead of the course instructors coming up with assignments and assigning them to students, they basically just opened up a list and they said, come up with your own assignments, whatever they may be, and then add them to this assignment bank. And then you, as a student, pick something from the assignment bank and do it. And that's what they did. And so we have this mechanism here where the project or the task-based nature of the course turns the course almost into this giant resource creation factory. And the course itself consists of people making these things and sharing these things. Yeah, Lisa's article really is a good article. What we've seen more recently, and of course the stuff that's been covered in the press and in the media and has been of most interest to the universities, are the content-based MOOCs, sometimes called XMOOCs, created by Coursera and Udacity, Udemy, Khan Academy, and the like. And what they are basically are broadcast courses. They're courses where the university creates all the content and then it broadcasts it out to students. And then they might have a discussion area and they might have some student activities, but these are all centralized and they're all planned ahead of time. These don't really work with OERs, do they? Think about what's happening here. They have to make all of their content. So they're not making use of any of the whole OER sphere. They're not bringing in content created by participants. So there isn't this element of creativity. These courses are expensive to produce. They cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to produce because there's so much upfront work on creation of course content. Are these sustainable long term? I'm not sure. The CMOOCs, I believe, are sustainable. The CMOOCs specifically use OERs, and they use OERs in a way that avoids the whole problem of mixing resources, because we don't mix resources. All we do is we link them. So if somebody has a non-commercial resource and someone has a buy resource, we can use both in the course because all we're doing is we're linking to those resources. And so there's no limit on the content that we use. But these courses, the content-based courses, have much greater restrictions because really what they're doing is they're taking whatever external resources they take, if any, and they're combining them all into this package that is owned by the university, and you're given the ability to look at it, but that's about it. So I'm going to skip this slide. I'm sorry. What makes one of our courses work are the properties that make it open and interactive. And these properties are, in my mind, autonomy, diversity, openness again, and interactivity. These are the properties of open educational resources. These are the properties of the use of these resources to support learning. And these are the properties that make a MOOC successful. And just, again, to take one more swipe at the XMOOCs, these are the properties that are exactly the properties that are not followed by Coursera and Udacity and the rest of it. So people always ask, how do you evaluate learning in these networks? The content-based MOOCs evaluation is based on remembering content, but in the network-based MOOCs, it's based on how you interact with people, how you traverse the network. It's based on the resources you contribute, the conversations you have, and it's based not from a position of authority, but it's based on your interactions and dealings with the rest of the network. And that's a long conversation we could have, which I don't have time for right now. This is a blank slide. The future now, my original plan was to have you all do, what do you think will be in the future? But you can think now about what the future will look like. Think about, the different types of devices, mobile devices, GPSs, sensor networks, all of these things that can create these interactive, open online courses that aren't just content that you have to memorize, but stuff that you do in combination with each other, in community with each other. And you can look at the directions that technology is moving now and think about the kinds of devices, but not just that. Think about the way we would use these devices. Think about GPS, for example. Imagine you lived in a world just before GPSs were invented. Imagine the different ways people would use them. Well, what would they use them for? They would use them to track where they rode their bicycle. They would use them to prevent themselves from being lost. They would use them to find out where they are, stuff like that. They would use them to map bus routes and pipelines and all of that sort of stuff. Now imagine some sort of technology that's just coming into currency, like Google Glass. And the idea here is, imagine how you would use Google Glass. If you had a heads-up display in front of you with information about, well, who knows what, how would you use that? That's how to think about the future, right? And we can think about the future in structured, thoughtful ways. I've got a paper there on the processes of change. People typically think about the future as, it's just going to be a projection of the way it is now. But it isn't. It's going to be a process of change. And there are many ways change happens. And the future is a mixture of all of those kinds of changes. But the main point I wanted to make about this with this slide is the future is not mysterious. The future is not unknown. People don't, we hear all the time people say, well, nobody can predict the future. That's not true. If nobody can predict the future, we would all die, because the very act of living is predicting the future. Why do you eat bread? You eat bread because you know if you eat bread, you won't be hungry, and it will sustain you in the future. So, why do you study? Why are you learning stuff? Because you have some understanding of what the world will be like in the future, and you believe that having this knowledge, this capacity, this skill will help you make more money or live more meaningfully in the future. So the future can be predicted. And people who tell you, oh, nobody can know what the future holds, they're lying. And I don't know why they're lying, but they're lying. That's all I have to say. And I'm Stephen Downs. And I thank you for your time, your attention, and especially your enthusiastic participation and staying overtime. I really appreciate it. Kim. Oh, no, that wasn't a Kim. I'm open to any comments, questions. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. I really tried. I did. Monday. And then Jean. Thanks, Margo. I'm glad it helped. I really appreciate that. No mic icon. Okay, Allison differentiated learning in MOOCs. can they become accessible to all? It really depends on what is meant by differentiated learning. So can you give me a sentence in the chat area that tells me what you mean by differentiated learning? And Jean, it looks like you're ready to talk, so maybe you can talk while Wendy searches for a microphone. Short answer is no. I think it's a great idea. I would really encourage it. If you can get high school students to participate in extracurricular learning like that. And, you know, I think back to my own high school experiences, and there was always that crowd who would, and then a much larger crowd who wouldn't. But if it's something that you can draw people into, I think it would really depend a lot on the MOOC, wouldn't it? You know, if it was one of these Coursera MOOCs where, you know, they're just giving you lesson after lesson every week, I'm not sure people would find that so interesting or engaging. If it was, you know, the digital storytelling where they're making, you know, animated videos and movies and you're supporting them locally with help and resources, I think people would definitely get engaged in that. So I think it has, you know, my main advice would be choose the MOOC carefully. But I'm speaking just from, you know, conceptual, not from practical experience here. And you know, I would certainly hope that, you know, you keep some kind of record and pass it on so other people can learn from that experience. Let me address Allison's point. She's expanded on differentiated learning, saying, I'm thinking about learning disabilities and other needs where learners may require other supports in the classroom, private space. Here's my thinking on that. And this does inform the design of the MOOC. And my thinking, you know, because I've dealt with accessibility issues a fair bit over the years, because accessibility issues are, you know, front and center in any sort of online learning that you develop. And of course, for people in the United States, they have to work within the framework of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which makes it necessary for them to think about, you know, what about people who can't see? What about people who can't hear? And also, it's personal. I have terrible, terrible eyesight. And as a result, my learning is impacted quite a bit by that. And I've adapted over the years. And my thinking is that instead of creating one resource that does everything, you create multiple resources covering the same topic and then have people pick the resources that work for them. I've always felt that that's the better way to do it. It's the better way because we're not trying to prescribe the way you should learn this material. It's we're giving people a choice of, you know, here's some audio, here's some video, here's some text, here's some games, here's some people you can talk to, here's some conceptual art, whatever. And they have this set of things they can draw from, and they draw from that set those materials that are most appropriate to them. And the design of MOOCs generally has been such that we provide many, many more resources than a person can use. And it becomes, you know, even in the selection, you know, what top do you cover? What are your areas of emphasis? People select different things according to their own choice. And most of all, it has been about people choose the form of their education. We don't prescribe it. We don't tell the blind person, you must take the audio recordings. And I always think back to the time on the student newspaper where we were selecting movie reviewers, and one person came and said, I'd love to be a movie reviewer, but I'm blind. And we said, that's great. You're one of our reviewers. And we sent this person off to review movies. And why not? It's a matter of choice. It's a matter of people choosing what they can do and what they can't do, not us saying what they can do and not do. So instead of trying to design the one big thing that does everything, designing many small things and letting people pick them up and link them together themselves. I hope that answers your question. That's just my thinking about it. I'm looking at the comments as well. Interesting comments. Alex, any follow-up? Oh, you're very welcome. And just to answer some of the questions, I will be posting these on my website. My website, as you can see, is downs.ca. I'm not sure exactly when they'll go up, but they'll certainly go up this weekend sometime. My slides and my audio, I'll post the links to the recordings or the actual recordings from the Collaborate environment as soon as Alex sends them to me. And yes, you can use these materials. Use them however you want. Use them, reuse them, fold, spindle, mutilate them. I don't care what you do to them. Just don't block access to them. Share them widely. Thanks, Alex. Bye, everyone. Alex. I got all the way through to the end before I mispronounced your name.